Well, I'm glad they don't work around here.
This building is a lot of people sick all the time.
I got the crud.
You do?
Yeah, we have.
I'm glad you're over there then. Oh, I'm bracketed. Oh, no. So I'm going to try and have folks keep the comments, general comments, general comments. And so if there, because we have action item comment period section, so I'm going to try to say.
Pointer.
Okay.
Stop. Thank you.
It would also move your slide.
Okay, I think we're going to go ahead and get started with our afternoon session. The board is back in session. The first item on the agenda for this afternoon is our second public comment period. And just as a reminder for the board and those in attendance that this is a bit of an experiment for us to have a second public comment period in the afternoon to provide members of the public that weren't able to attend this morning's session an opportunity to comment on items that are not action items that have their separate agenda items. So I will ask those of you who have signed up for comment in the general comment area to keep your comments focused on items that do not have a separate comment period. Thank you. So we have separate comment periods for the action items, and that sign-in sheet remains over by the front door with the table. So anybody who wishes to sign up on a particular item, please do so. And in the general comment period, if you could keep your comments focused to items that are not action items. And I will try to help you with that. It's a bit of an experiment, and I want to make sure that we aren't just adding more comment periods on the action items. So. Okay, now with that, we have six members of the public who have signed up to provide testimony, and the first one is Pete Heide. Good afternoon, Pete.
Hello again, Madam Chair and members of the board. Thank you for this opportunity, and I think it's interesting to have these second opportunities, I guess. First thing I want to say is that when Jim Hotbed wrote his little explanation, and he included of what was going on in Seymour, he included the change in co-chairs, and I need to mention that he did not have Adrian Miller's position correct. In fact, the position that he talked about in that first paragraph was what Adrian used to do for WFPA, and now he's the Manager of Policy and Sustainability for Long Beach Timber Company. So just wanted to correct that.
So noted in the record. Thank you.
Primarily, I want to talk about the some of the comments that were made earlier by Mr. Goldman regarding fish habitat. And some of you may have been around when we negotiated forests and fish, and we indeed did negotiate to and decided on and wrote in the forests and fish report the fact that we were going to protect fish habitat. And I guess what I'm here to say to you right now is that we, the landowners, and the DNR, along with Fish and Wildlife and other stakeholders, in our view, have been protecting fish habitats since the initiation of the Forest and Fish Forest Practices Rules. And I just wanted to read to you the definition that's currently in the rules of what fish habitat means. And this is not part of the water typing. This is in the definition section 222.16.010. And fish habitat is defined as a fish habitat means habitat which is used by fish at any life stage or any time of the year, including potential habitat likely to be used by fish, which could be recovered by restoration or management, and it includes off-channel habitat. Now, that's the definition that we've been applying, as far as I can understand, when we conduct the surveys to determine where fish habitat is. As you know, the current interim rule says you're either going to do these physicals, 2 feet, 20% gradient as the limit of fish habitat, or you have the opportunity to determine where fish habitat exists, and you could do that through a survey. And I'll say that almost, well, in my None of the surveys end at the last fish. None of the calls on fish habitat end at the last fish. There's always the professional people out there. You have to be certified to do the survey work. The fish biologists, they find out where the fish are. They look upstream to decide where the fish are likely to be. And in some cases, in many cases, if there's restoration of the habitat possible, where they are likely to be in the future. One of our members has gone through a little analysis and found that over 70 miles of habitat is being protected on their lands as a result of these habitats beyond where the last fish was found. And I also mentioned, just for as part of this, that there's, and you know this because it's in DNR's reports, over 1,300 miles of fish habitat has been opened up as a result of removing fish blockages. So the industry has been protecting fish habitat since the Forest and Fish Forest Practices Rules were passed, first with a temporary rule in 2000 and then in 2001.
I'd elected to mention that we only have 10 minutes scheduled on our agenda for this time period, so I'm going to allow each member of the public 3 minutes for this particular comment period, and Shane will help keep me on task, and I won't cut you off in the middle of the sentence, but I'll try to ask you to summarize if I think you are getting, if you're beyond the time. Next member of the public is Chris Mendoza. And Chris Mendoza has just walked in the room, and I'm sure he would like to come right up and provide his public testimony since he has signed up to do so.
Sorry, Kevin had me by the neck out there.
So you only have a minute and a half, Chris.
Uh-oh.
We are...
I think that time to do Kevin's testimony.
Minutes.
Yes. Yeah, I just had a couple comments on the general comments on the Clean Water Act document that was to the board from Mark Hick. And I just want to make a couple points. One is that the... we're in general agreement with a lot of the priorities in this memo. There's some that aren't shared by... other stakeholders, including the Conservation Caucus, they're few, but I think they're worth noting. One is that there's a prioritization process that's happened at both the CEMER level and at the policy level. If you look at the CEMER work plan, it's got a prioritization process in there, kind of describes how we go about prioritizing our projects based on potential risk to the resource and the amount of science underlying specific rules. And we have doing type-F effectiveness. CEMER has determined that that's pretty high up on the list. And if you look at that list in our plan, it says statewide type-F effectiveness. And the policy prioritization list that was in the budget last year approved by the board also has a type-F effectiveness on the west side as a second priority. So there's inconsistencies between I think ecology's prioritization list on some items and other work lists. And so what we'd like to see is a process that maintains the consistency between those, acknowledging that ecology's role in ensuring that Clean Water Act assurances are met is key, and I think that's shared by most stakeholders. I think that where things begin to diverge is once you've met that, and there's other projects, as the AMPA document shows, that CEMER's got another 60 projects on the list. Where do you go from there as far as additional projects that need to be picked up that are currently delayed? So my advice to the board, with all due respect, is simply to make sure you have all those documents and that you crosswalk them to see where any of those divergences may occur.
Thank you.
That's all.
Thank you for your comment. And just a reminder, we asked Ecology to do this. The board had asked them to prioritize, and DNR had asked Ecology to prioritize, but appreciate your perspective on making sure that crosswalks appropriately. Okay, next member of the public is Rick Dunning. Good afternoon, Rick.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the board. For the record, my name is Rick Dunning, and I have here my own little three-minute timer that I just hit start on. First, and on behalf of Washoe Farm Forestry, I just want to thank all of you board members, but specifically Sherry Fox and Doug Stimson for their time on this board. and it's been very meaningful. We know you've given a lot, Doug, and Sherry the same, and we're just very thankful of it. I want that to be said. So now I just ask the board to maybe be entertained a little bit, but just help me connect these dots and bear with my commentary also. For nearly 60 years, our association has had the same purpose. We provide education to small forest landowners in the state. Second purpose, and I quote, is to promote development of fair taxation and regulation on the federal, state, and local government levels so that forest management, and this is the key, can continue through generations as a viable and attractive way of life. Well, I'm paid to do that. That's what my job is, to try and maintain that. And as a businessman, for the last 30 years in this state, as a tree farmer for the last 25, and as the ED of this association for the last 9, I just ask you to listen to me, that I have failed that job. I have not found the method by which we can maintain this viability. I'm going to connect some dots there. Now I want to read the Forest Practice Board legislative mandate. It's right over there on your table. It says the board is charged with establishing rules to protect the state's natural resources while maintaining a viable timber industry. And I just challenge you all that we are part of that timber industry. If you look at the acres out here in this state, we have a whole bunch of small forest landowners, and it should be very important to this state how we treat them as businesses. Their economic viability does matter. Now, I'd like to read from the state's 2002 Small Forest Landowner Statute, RCW 7613-100. Number 2 and 110, number 3, the legislature further finds that a riparian easement program shall be established to acquire easements for small forest landowners. We believe this is a functional riparian easement program. And small forest landowners should have the option of alternate management plans or harvest restrictions. These are two key points on smaller harvest units and while requiring less costly prescriptions. We have not implemented this. I again bring this to your attention today, which I've done before, because in light of another failed template effort, and once again, another written small business economic impact statement, this one on the burn fees instituted by this agency recently, once again, DNR rules and policy are adding additional burdens and disproportionate financial impacts on small forest landowners in this state. So we do have a solution to this, and we would love to get some traction to have others. I know I'm not. Lastly, I'd like to bring your attention to another handout that I asked Patricia to give in. It's a Bill Ruckelhaus article in the Capital Press. It was well done. I think we all can respect that man and his experience and what he's done for the state. And he says some very important things in there. And I ask you, I took the time to get it on 2 pages for you, and I took the time to highlight a few items. I just ask you sincerely to read that. And please contact me with any questions or comments or input you might have on how we might resolve this issue, because it is a huge concern for us, and we hope it is for this board. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. Appreciate your comments. Okay, next we have Steve Stinson. You need not bring your own timer, we have one.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the board. Commend you for giving a second opportunity to testify. It's always appreciated. My name is Steve Stinson. I'm a family forest landowner in Lewis County. I primarily came here to acknowledge the efforts of board members Sherry Fox and Doug Stinson and their efforts to address family forest landowners and the implementation of the forest and fish package. I'm particularly sorry to see that Sherry's not here today. I know she's got some health issues. I can't think of another person that's dedicated more of their life and time and energy than Sherry Fox to see the family forest landowners have got a place at the table. It's been almost a year since I presented to this board, and not much has happened, although I did cut my hair, so it's not hiding in the ponytail. And unfortunately, Forest and Fish has broken every promise that was made to family forest landowners. The Small Forest Landowner Office has gone from a staff of 12 to 2. The Forest Repairing Easement Program was chronically underfunded. The alternate planning process is broken. Now more than ever, it ought to be clear that we need a family forest landowner rule package that provides the smaller buffers on smaller streams with smaller harvest units that was promised in the original forest and fish rule package. Quite simply, family forest landowners, who by the way are the largest private landowner class by acres owned, are being regulated under an industrial approach and it isn't working. We have presented a solution at the legislative level that will accomplish this goal for at least the west side of this state. Your support for this solution would be most appreciated. Appreciate this opportunity to share my thoughts. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Steve. Questions? Steve, I'd like to just mention that this morning I also thanked Doug and Sherry for their service. This being technically their last last board meeting for their existing tenure, and we talked about what that meant. But
what does that mean?
It means you serve until a replacement is appointed. Although we haven't disagreed with that, because it's always well received. Maybe that's the easiest way to put it. But but we agree that their participation has been really helpful to the process and really is a very strong voice for the small forest landowners. So I just wanted to echo that and let you know that we, the board, also recognize them and appreciate
that. Excellent.
I
appreciate that acknowledgement. Thank you.
Okay, Ken Miller. With crops.
Don't worry, I didn't bring a tent. I'm not here to occupy.
Olympia. Do you need help with my handouts?
No, I think I can just fine.
Chairman Moran and members of the board, I've submitted earlier written testimony, and so I'll just touch on the highlights and lowlights, if you prefer, of that testimony, and then briefly go through some of this. I am Ken Miller, representing small forest landowners. As been mentioned before, family forest owners are exhausted with the process, seemingly unable to address the legislative promises of forests and fish. This issue cannot be resolved by a passive board waiting for agency or policy recommendations. We should be sitting here today in a multi-stakeholder panel helping you finalize some low impact decisions. The forest and fish regulatory community has never taken these low impact promises and commitments seriously. Similar to the tribes, SFLOs traded away some of their property rights and for financial and regulatory promises that were too quickly forgotten by the parties to this timber war treaty. Most of the forest and fish stakeholders are about genuinely trying to give us something, but it's something that we already own and are entitled to keep. The legislature already made that policy decision for us. I want to remind everybody that the take of forest and fish affects thousands of landowners, and not millions, but billions of dollars. Agency folks brag that they are only protecting functions. I argue that the handling of this low-impact template effort shows that functions are us is at best a sham. In the end, the low-impact template was rejected without comment and without forest practice board involvement. So I don't get nervous. I promise I won't spend any more time on all this supporting data than what I think the agencies have already spent themselves, if you get my drift. They didn't spend any time on this stuff. But basically, we spent a year putting together a pretty complete package of a document, a template, well supported. We followed all the processes and formats. We gathered the concerns that were voiced to us and tried to address them in this last draft. We followed the guidelines for alternate plans. We provided lots and lots of science documentation that supported the general notion that low impact harvesting within the RMZs are a good thing. There was a couple of papers that were part of the draft Clean Water Act assurances review. There was a report, a scientific literature review that we referred to that had 179 scientific articles, 4,000 pages, all supporting low impact management. And they had a chapter on just about everything. My printer finally broke down before I got to the end of it. we referred to Department of Ecology modeling the effects of repairing buffer width on effective shade and stream temperature. In summary, said anything under 500 feet of stream reach wasn't likely to impact the water temperature. That's why we stayed under 500 feet. And it's my understanding that there's at least a couple of very similar existing studies in CEMER that say the same thing for even greater harvest levels. So we stayed well within the bounds. We also referred to the riparian adaptive management symposium that was held in Forks. It's a conversation between science and management that talks about how the science is changing. We know more than we did when Forest and Fish was passed. Bottom line, it's more productive for fish to have patchy disturbance landscapes and mid-successional forests. Even the Pacific Northwest Research Center, we all get these statements. One of them came out and said that management efforts should focus on the riparian vegetation if we want to keep midsummer water flows going. Society of American Foresters put out a paper that talked about the value of managing RMCAs and RMCs rather than just leaving them as abandonment zones. And finally, we provided an awful lot of risk analysis in our paper that used the data from the Rural Technology Institute, which came from people in this room going to Washington, D.C., and asking for money because we small landowners believe that if we don't have the data to support where we are, who we are, how much stream impact, nobody's going to listen to us. So they got over $1 million. RTI developed the process, and in the end, nobody still listens to us. The risk analysis we showed was that the only risks are potential and theoretical. They're clearly de minimis, or as my father would say, they're no bigger than a pimple on a dimple on a fleas. But
Ken, I'm going to have to ask you to summarize and remind you that this
is. And in closing, then, our peers tried to tell us, Phil Hess and I, that the agencies are not going to look at supporting science, statistics, RCWs, or functional protections. None of those matter. To me, this is a clear example of regulatory bullying. I would be delighted to answer any of your questions. Oh, and I want to, excuse me, one more thing. I know Mark Engel's sitting there in the background. He's anticipating that I'm going to shove all of this stuff that nobody paid any attention into the garbage can. But I didn't feel I'd be really respectful of you and this group. But I want you all to try to imagine, having gone through all of this work and found all of this supporting data, and then have it totally disregarded as far as you know. No one ever invited you into a conversation about any of this supporting documentation. So we have we can't assume anything other than it was totally disregarded. That's not right.
Thank you, Ken. Anna?
Hi, Ken. Thanks for coming today. I just wanted to let you know on behalf of DFW that we've read your testimony carefully, and it really disheartens me to hear that this is your interpretation of how the last 8 months has gone. And I won't go into detail right now, but we have a different interpretation, and we're considering just for the board's general public's reference, actually putting that in writing and making it part of the public record too, because I do feel it's being disingenuous to say that we haven't spent time working on this, that you haven't had any opportunity to sit down and talk about. I mean, we can talk offline about it, but I know I've been part of meetings, our staff has been part of meetings, other agencies have. Just a couple quick points. I mean, I know you hear this, but it's true that we have to meet the intent of the law, and part of that is protecting public resources. Understand completely, if we can get alternatives to doing that, we can talk about it. And we thought this was a genuine attempt to get there. It's my understanding that this template actually provides more opportunities than under the fixed width buffer template, and that was the starting point for this, and this goes beyond that. So to hear also that this is not going to be useful at all for any small forest owners, I think is putting it a little bit out of context as well. So I want to say that we really appreciate your time, and I'd love to talk with you more, but I do think it's unfair to characterize it in the way that it has been, because it's been quite a process and a lot of time invested.
Thank you, and we'll have a separate comment period on this topic.
Yes, that's just what I was going to say, but I hope that nothing has come across in any of my comments that don't give due credit to the folks that I've testified before and have said and will continue saying. I know that agency folks behind me have spent a lot of time and effort on this, and I know that they are trying to help. So let's not get into the disingenuous is tough for me, because I don't personally believe that.
Thank you for that clarification, and thank you for that. Okay, last member of the public for general comment is Ridian Morgan. And I hope I pronounced that correctly.
You did.
Okay.
Good afternoon. My name is Ridian Morgan. I'm here essentially to support Ken Miller's position. I would summarize my reaction going all the way back to the TFW process, and I was in a room with Bledsoe and Frank when the first discussions approaching the small landowners that there was going to be an alternate regime. And I have to tell you that the latest experience is one more example of the agencies, sorry, am I not coming through? This is one more example of the agencies telling the small landowner, just go away. Now, I've got a lot of experience with different agencies, and if you want chapter and verse, I can give it to you, but I'm not going to go outside my 2 minutes. I wrote you a letter. I hope you read it. I meant it. We've been there 60 years. We've had a lot of trouble, and much of it is from second-level agency people who don't read the ground, and it scares me. Because I'm dealing with the approach of suburbia, and I've got 3 or 4 different options that would get rid of all of that timberland and probably make my family members very rich. Every time we have a process like this, the arguments for conversion get better and better. And I would finally add, after a recent experience with DFW, DOE, over the Mud Lake settlement, I've decided that Peter Goldman is right. The way to get attention is to sue, and we're doing that. And it may be very expensive for the state by the time it's finished. So I would wish you'd pay more attention to Ken Miller, who believed he could get something out of this process. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair, may I please have 1 minute? Excuse me, I forgot to sign up.
You may have 1 minute.
Sorry.
Shane.
Thank you, I appreciate it. Peter Goldman from the Conservation Caucus. I need to set the record straight about something that Mr. Heide said. The argument is that we said, or that I said, that the industry, the forest and fish, is not protecting fish habitat. Mr. Heide read from the definition of fish habitat, 010. What he didn't do is he didn't read the implementing rule that's in place right now, 031. And 031 only, it's the Lenny Young memo. It applies to the last nose of the fish, plus a little bit more. That's what it does. It does not protect ordinary off-channel habitat, and it allows protocol survey, electrofishing, to eliminate habitat that is connected. So it's disingenuous for Mr. Heide to say that they're protecting fish habitat by reading a definition without reading the rule, that's the interim rule that's in place right now. So we need to fix the problem. We're not taking fish habitat all the way up to the top of the ridge, but there is something's got to change. Then we are not protecting what we thought we were going to be protecting. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so that was our experiments and additional public comments. It went a little long. We'll have to adjust our timelines in the future, but I think it was still a few minutes that folks come in the afternoon. Okay, the next item on our agenda is a specific public comment period on the board manual section 21 alternate plans, and we have 2 members of the public who have signed up to testify. We have 10 minutes scheduled for this topic, so I'll give you each 5 minutes. It's Ken Miller first, followed by Steve Stinson. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify before I split the time in half? Now is your chance. Okay. There we go.
Patricia will pass out what I'm asking.
Okay.
Reading the record, if I may.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members of the board, I'm still Ken Miller, still representing the small forest landlords. As I testified earlier today, small landowners brought forward a low impact template that should have been viewed as a full meal deal that addressed all the known regulatory issues and had real potential for final resolution of these long-standing small landowner issues and promises. The state agencies ignored that offer and instead offered something entirely different, a lemon. Now, my friend Mark Engel is the one that actually gave me this lemon with a smiley face on it to show that he shares my intent to get through all this serious stuff with good humor and friendships intact. So that's my goal here. Although a friend, I'm going to try to embarrass him by showing why this alternate template in fact is a lemon, despite what I know are Mark and other stakeholders' good intentions. I don't have time in this format to go into detail, so I hope you will ask clarifying questions and save the harder ones for Mark. As I testified at your last meeting, smalls were highly disappointed that the state stonewalled our proposal, but we were willing to stay at the table in hopes of finding anything marginally beneficial. What's before you today is not even an apple slice, it's a lemon, for the following reasons, and I itemized five out here. First, Mark and the rest of the state caucus already have embarrassed themselves after all their hard work and first draft of Eastside prescriptions that were immediately recognized as more restrictive than the existing rules. The template being offered here today, or we offered a statewide template, the one offered today now only applies to the west side. In search of something even marginally beneficial, we shared the attached concerns, both verbally and written, quickly concluding with DNR that even this additional thinning template was a bridge too far. These concerns and conclusions were shared with other stakeholders at the Small Landowner Advisory Committee meeting, and we mistakenly thought this was a dead issue. I don't find any of our concerns addressed in the latest draft. Third, after the small landowner advisory meeting, where there was zero landowner support, we learned indirectly that DNR intended to push this template forward to the board. Regardless of any likely good intentions, how can small landowners that have been at the table for the last 10 plus years feel this is anything but a blatant regulatory power play intended to stuff something down our throats? Or stuff it somewhere else. Number four, the example for site 2 and 3 below compares the fixed width buffers intended to be used with this new template and the existing option 1 thinning from below. This template is patterned after. It appears this template might be simpler than option 1, but it should be noted that few industrial landowners even use this option 1, despite their having the ability to read through the complexity and work needed to utilize this option. The upland clear-cut area in the fixed width buffers is generally about the same as the existing option 1. The template proposal would allow thinning in the rest of the outer zone and the entire inner zone. The existing option 1 rule allows clear-cutting in the entire outer zone, except for some widely spaced single trees, and already allows thinning in the entire inner zone. In other words, it's about the same as the existing buffer widths, except the existing rule already allows thinning. So what's new? How does something that is the same as existing rules qualify as helping address disproportionate impact? The fifth and last point
is, in addition to believing the proposed template will not be marginally additive, we believe it is actually more restrictive than the existing rules, just as was the case in the deleted e-site prescriptions. Below are some examples of actual FTAs where three different industrial landowners got through the complexity to actually utilize the existing option one thinning opportunities. There are probably some complex technical reasons someone may try to give to explain away the differences, but the bottom line is the state's well-intended offer to us in this template doesn't allow near as much interzone thinning as the existing rules. The template you have been asked to approve limits interzoning thinning to RD50, which really isn't thinning at all. This template you are, yet examples from the approved FPAs show interzone thinning well below RD50 and as low as below 20. That's offered to smalls. In fact, the examples I've cited here in the paper, all of the pre-harvest interzone densities in these examples started at levels that are below what we're offered as post-thinning. So how does it make any sense to offer smalls RD50 when if you use existing rules, you go down to, and this one example here goes down to RD18. Ironically, the last FPA example that I've included here has a project name of No Bull. In addition to all the concerns, we believe it's bull to try to sell us a template advertised as good work with a thinning table based on RD50. Pretty easy to see why non-landlords are supporting this empty suit.
Please summarize, Ken.
I will. I hope that you see why we are offended by this attempt to help us with the kind of help we don't want and certainly don't deserve. Even if Mark comes up with some hypothetical estimates of folks with stands technically eligible to use this template, do you understand this simpler template? Do you think it's appropriate to give this lemon to smalls, knowing it will most likely be used as an illegitimate example of the kind of regulatory help we've been promised by the legislature? I hope you have questions and at least concerns. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions for Ken? Thank you, Ken. Paul.
This might be just more of a general comment, and I have to say that and I'm hoping the presentation by state staff will help a little bit, but it is a little distressing to hear such widely varied opinions, and so no delegitimization of your opinions or the state's opinions, but it just seems to me like we haven't figured a way for the caucuses to talk to each other in a way that's productive yet, and I don't know what we can do about that, but you know, I hear how distressed you are, and that's distressing to me, and to have your community be so upset. But I also know that state agency folks, being a former state agency person myself, probably very, very hard to come at this and try to figure something out. So at some point, I would like us to figure out how to break through what are apparently communication barriers, and whether it's a fundamental lack of understanding of what the parameters are that everybody has to operate in. But I would like to see more in-depth attempts to try to break through this, since we've been seeing it for a few years now. And as a board member, I don't know what to do about it, but it's not a good state of affairs. So I would just offer up, as a general comment, that it looks like we have to try harder to come to resolution.
I would like to set the record straight as far as once we got through rejecting our template and the state came up with this proposal that's before you today, that the landowners and DNR did have some very constructive, open, frank, honest discussions, in fact, at my house. And those were very good, and the And the end result of those was, despite the best intentions of everybody, the bridge, the gap between where we were and where the state felt they could go was just, it was a bridge too far. So that's why we thought, okay, you know, that's the end of Ken and Phil's process. And thank you very much. Adios. And then we find kind of after the fact that now it's being brought up, even though, you know, landowners are saying it's just, it doesn't work.
Doug.
Ken, I first of all want to thank you very, very much. This is beyond yeoman's work. And what you've, the hours you put into this thing are unbelievable. I know the pay rates lacks just a little bit. But it shows the tenacity that you have for digging into something. And I think the end result of this is pointing out some real things to the board, that there's some real unfair equity here. So I think it's not all going to go to waste. At least I hope it doesn't. Because there are some big issues here that the smalls are facing, and you've done a tremendous job, Ken, bringing it up and airing it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.
Steve. Ken, use all your time, so no, I'm just kidding. No.
Left
you also
props.
Have 5 minutes.
I can do this quickly. That's a tough act to follow. Madam Chair and members of the board, I'm still Steve Stinson and still a family forest landowner in Lewis County, but for this segment I would like to acknowledge an additional burden that I have, which is a master's degree in silviculture and an in-depth understanding of the forest metric relative density. I was one of the majority in our caucus that didn't want Ken and Phil to go forward with this low-impact template. Based on all my past experience with forest and fish and the mired Lewis County Habitat Conservation Plan, I was convinced no one in this town was going to pay any attention to the supporting documentation. By keeping the patch cut to harvest very small and using existing rules and procedures, they convinced us that the low-impact template actually had a chance, if only to put our best foot forward one last time before we totally gave up on these processes. I fully support the comments of Ken Miller regarding this proposal. As acknowledged, he's done a yeoman's effort in trying to put a complex issue in a manner that's somewhat understandable before you. But to call this proposal low impact is inaccurate. The current rule actually allows, as Ken said, more flexibility than this proposal. Worst of all, this proposal simply will not work on the ground. The relative density floor of 50 is ecologically impossible. Generally, foresters like myself and others use a range of relative density 35 to 45 as a ceiling. Maintaining an RD floor of 50 will keep the stand on the verge of shutting down in what we call the stem exclusion stage, which provides the lowest level of biodiversity of any stand stage. Such a high level of relative density will also preclude a stand's ability to reach the levels of growth identified in the template. In other words, they simply cannot get there. As a scientist and a family forest landowner, I'd like to have the record show that I do not support this template proposal, as it has several flaws that make it unworkable on the ground.
Thank you, Steve. Questions for Steve? Yes, Norm.
Steve, given the fairly large disparity between the proposal that Ken and Phil put forward in terms of the relative density number and what has come in the state proposal that we'll be speaking about here a little bit later. Is there a place somewhere in between that you think would be a suitable number?
Well, yeah, I think you could run with a relative density ceiling, I guess, as the state is using it, of 30 to 35. That would probably work. We're fortunate we've got Robert Curtis, retired silviculture emeritus right here in the research station just south of us that came up with relative density some years ago. So we have some local experience and efforts on how this could actually work. It's actually a rather robust metric. Beats the heck out of basal area as far as I'm concerned. But it is complex, and I think beyond a lot of folks' just general grasp if you don't dive into it. And I think if you don't fully understand it, it's easy to just pick a high number and stick with it just from the conservative nature of the thing. But no, I think if you used a ceiling of 35, then we'd have a place to start, absolutely.
And based on your education and your experience, and you said in Masters of Silviculture, I think, do you have in mind any kind of a process by which the stakeholders could actually review that? I'm sure that relative density is probably a sort of a way out there sort of number. It's kind of like imagining how email communications work through the airwaves. You know, it's just, it happens, we get them, but we don't know how. Well, I'm guessing that RD 30, 40, 50, whatever it is much the same to most of us. Is there a way in which the concept of that and the differences between what a stand looks like at 50 and what it looks like at 30 and the ecological functions that can be provided at those different levels and the management options that could be available, that could be presented to the stakeholders, to this board, so that it becomes more understandable in order to reconcile and determine what is the appropriate number for a rule?
I think so.
What would you recommend?
What would I recommend?
How would we get there?
I think you might just start with a board workshop on what relative density is. Maybe get Bob Curtis in here and walk down through it. It's not that complicated. I mean, it's basal area divided by the quadratic mean diameter of the stand. It's basal area, trees, average diameter. Pretty simple stuff. You lay that out on tables, grow it out over time.
It's visualizing what does that look like,
right,
that I think creates some of the hurdle. You know, again, it's the same hurdle of how do the electrons get from over here to over there in a way that we can really communicate with each other.
And I'm actually fairly confident within the Department of Natural Resources there are foresters that would be quite capable of putting something together like that.
Other questions for Steve? Thank you, Steve.
Thank you for the time.
Okay. Now we are going to move on to presentation by DNR staff, Tammy Makita and Mark Engel, regarding Board Manual Section 21, Alternate Plans. Welcome. Good afternoon. Please be sure to share the microphone appropriately so everyone can hear you.
I'll keep it up there for the symbolism so the board will know they got a real clear voice.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair and members of the board, again, I'm still Mark Engel. The legislature, as Rick Dunning pointed out, intended small forest landowners to have the option of alternate management plans on smaller units that have a relatively low impact on aquatic resources. The board established rules governing alternate plans, including the creation of alternate plan templates. And for the record, a template is a form of an alternate plan. In the case of small forest landowners, the alternate plan process can be used as a tool to deal with the disproportionate impact of the regulations, again, pointed out by both Rick and Pam. The rules emphasize, in all cases, the alternate planning process, including templates, will result in a plan that provides protection to public resources at least equal in overall effectiveness as provided in the Act and the rules. Because of the standard, alternate plans and templates do not have to go through CEPA. The rules direct DNR to develop Board Manual Section 21, which is the Alternate Planning Board Manual for small forest landowners. The manual is to contain guidance to small forest landowners for alternate plans, and it's to contain templates for alternate harvest restrictions that meet riparian functions while generally requiring less costly regulatory prescriptions, again, as pointed out by Rick. Development of any template requires establishing eligibility requirements and harvest prescriptions designed to address common situations in a consistent manner. They must meet resource objectives, such as setting the RMZ on a course to meet DFC, while protecting public resources today. Designing prescriptions that will not set small forest landowners up for failure by establishing a template that won't get buy-off from reviewers. Templates are alternate plans and as such may be subject to ID team's review, and the rules clearly identify that ID teams will include representatives from ecology, Department of Fish and Wildlife, affected tribes, and the federal services, and other parties expressing interest in alternate plans within the geographic area of the forest practice application. The board has been presented a riparian thinning alternate plan template for small forest landowners in Western Washington for review and approval. The template was prepared by the state caucus to honor the fixed widths that already exist in template two, to assure the no harvest zone meets riparian function, that is the eligibility requirement. The no harvest zone for this template is the core zone, but we call it no harvest so that there's no confusion. And that the post-harvest trees and the thinning, which is the inner zone only, be left in a manner to meet resource objectives, such as EFC. I'd like to point out that this is not necessarily a low thinning, such as prescribed through DFC when you run the model. This is a thinning where, in the end, we need to meet the same average stand diameter, but they can take evenly from all tree sizes. Also, there's no requirements with this template, or for that matter, the fixed width template, to leave any trees in the outer zone. So in Ken's thing, he stated to you that this would be a thinning in the outer zone as well as the inner zone. That's not the case. The draft template was not approved by the advisory committee, as has been pointed out, and it did not receive consensus by policy. The forest practice rules, however, direct DNR to prepare and present to the board for approval amendments to the board meeting. DNR believes that this template is an additional tool for use by small forest landowners that addresses some of the disproportionate impacts of the regulations while maintaining resource objectives and protecting public resources. After Tammy provides the board a brief presentation on the proposed riparian thinning template, DNR requests board approval of the amended board manual section 21 as presented to you in your packet. The board manual has, we have noticed some things that needed additional clarification within the existing board manual. We've also established the templates as attachments, because the intent is that if a landowner is eligible to use a template, that they could take it from the board manual and, you know, add into the field in order to meet the prescriptions. While considering action, I ask the board to remember that an alternate plan template cannot deviate from the rules to the point that the template is establishing new rule through guidance. When in doubt, such a template would need formal adaptive management review. And that is something that we have put forward to the small forest landowners throughout this entire process, beginning last December. So the board has the opportunity, if they choose, to direct a template for that review. So with that, I'll have Tammy give a presentation on this template.
Thank you, Mark. Hello, Tammy.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the board. My name is Tammy Makita, and I would like to say that I'm 3.5 short months into the position of small forest landowner manager.
So be nice.
Doing a fabulous job.
Thank you. Today I'm going to tell you about the small forest landowner riparian management zone template number 3. I want to talk to you about what it is, what it contains, and how it's implemented. The thinning, the template applies, as Mark said, applies the fixed width riparian buffer, template number 2 for Western Washington. It also contains a 50-foot no-harvest zone and a thinning zone. The remainder outside the 50-foot no-harvest zone is called a thinning zone. There's a minimum number of trees in the no-harvest zone that needs to be maintained to be eligible. There's also a minimum number of trees to be left in the thinning zone to be eligible to thin. The template does not require, as Mark said, does not require any trees to be left in the outer zone. In fact, there is no outer zone. We believe that this template is much less complex than the standard rules, as there is no in-depth analysis such as RV or basal area that needs to be determined, and no stand calculations that can need to be conducted. It's not a requirement to be implemented. It's merely a tool for the small forest landowners, another tool for the small forest landowners to use in their toolbox. It allows harvest activities to be conducted throughout the entire inner zone, as Mark said. And if this plan does not work, landowners have the option to submit an alternate plan at any time. The one thing that this template is, it's real field oriented, so you can actually take this template out in the field and to determine whether or not you can qualify for thinning. You don't have to run it through a DSC model. You don't have to run it through any type of analysis. You use a table. It's a table-driven template. You look up tables in a chart and determine whether or not the trees you can thin in the riparian area. And I'll talk about the tables in a little bit later in my presentation. So we were interested in determining if the thinning template could actually be used by small forest landowners. So I recently gathered stand data from the Forest Practices Desired Future Condition model data set. As you know, the DFC model uses stand data that's entered by a landowner for a particular riparian stand. The DFC stand data is then processed and provides the landowner with an output that's comprised of stand-specific prescriptions that can be applied to the riparian stand under either option one or option two of DFC. The data that I gathered was comprised of this DFC riparian stand data that was input actually by landowners. So my goal in this analysis was to use the actual stand data on the ground and apply them to the requirements in this template to determine if the strategy is usable, if this template is usable to small forest landowners. So on the screen, I intentionally selected areas to analyze in which aerial photography showed there were concentrations of small forest landowners. I purposely didn't include areas where I felt there were blocks of industrial lands and areas where there was a large blocks of state and federal lands. So I intended to get a good distribution of the samples across Western Washington. This is actually Township 12 North 3 West, which is one sample of the data that I used, which is actually, this is in Lewis County. So there's currently a total of 2,291 stands. This area that, this circle that you see right here, right there, that's 12 North 3 West. So that's the area that we're using, one of the areas that I'm using in my data set. So there's currently 2,291 stands in the DFC model. In this analysis that I used 212 stands, which is roughly 10% of the DFC models. And I used these to determine whether or not it was appropriate for us to be able to be thinning in the riparian areas. I wanted to get a good distribution, so I actually, all of the red areas or the dark red areas are the areas that I took samples, data, DFC samples, and conducted my analysis. So I actually counted and selected 14 townships in Pacific Cascade region, which is down in the southwest. I used 78 stands, 7 townships in South Puget Sound region containing 49 stands, 9 townships up in the Olympic region, 5 townships in the Northwest region, and that was my sample size and the area that was analyzed. So in total, 212 stands. The distribution of the site classes that I analyzed actually came out fairly accurate to what the distribution of the site classes are found on the ground in Western Washington. There's most are in site class 2 and 3, with the least amount in 5, site class 4. So, what data did I collect? I collected stand age. The stand age ranged from age 32 to 75, with an average age of 49 and a half years. I collected diameter of trees, the tree species, whether they were hardwood or conifers, the number of trees in 2-inch diameter classes, the acres that were within the no harvest zone and the thinning zone, and the total number of trees per acre in the riparian area. So this is an example of what I queried. And this is actually 12 North 3 West. So you can see that site class 2 is the township and range. The age of this stand is 50. You can see the various diameter ranges, ranging from 6 to 22. The number of conifer trees for each diameter class, number of hardwood trees for each diameter class, how large the riparian area was that was analyzed, so this was 0.17 acres, and then how many trees per acre were in that area. So I did an analysis for inner zones and for the no harvest zones separate. So I selected no harvest zone data and inner zone data. So applying the riparian thinning template, to determine if a stand's eligible to thin, the riparian template requires two parameters. Only two parameters that need to be met. The no harvest core area, no harvest area, must have enough trees present in order to maintain the required riparian function. So there's a minimum number of trees required in the no harvest area. The inner zone, the thinning zone, must also have enough conifer trees left unharvested after the harvest activity is conducted to maintain that riparian function as well. So the two questions that a forester needs to ask to implement this template is, does the no harvest zone meet the eligibility requirements? As well as, are there enough conifer trees in the thinning zone that you can remain after the harvest is conducted? So the no harvest zone eligibility, this is one of the tables, when I told you this was a table-driven template, this is one of the tables that you have to use. It's a no harvest zone eligibility. This is actually from the riparian template. It requires that enough trees that of all species, so it's both conifer and hardwoods, that are at least 6 inches in diameter be present in the no harvest zone, so which is the 50 feet closest to the stream. The number of trees varies depending on the diameter, the stand diameter, average stand diameter. So for instance, in a no harvest zone, you have an average, let's say you have 18 inches, which is your average stand diameter, there's a requirement of 96 trees per acre that need to be left in that, need to stay in that no harvest zone. That's all species. So, what were the results of the analysis that I conducted?
Can I ask a question? I just want to make sure I'm understanding. The no harvest zone calculation here is simply to ensure that you're not thinning next to a situation that is already bad.
That is correct.
That's what this threshold is.
That's why it's called an eligibility. So you have to have so many trees in the no harvest zone to maintain that riparian function.
Okay.
If you're going to thin in the thinning zone.
In the thinning zone.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
sir. And I could do the calculation offline here, but I haven't. Is there a basal area or a correlation between your I guess I'm wondering where the threshold of 115 trees at 16 inches mm-hmm. came from. What's the origination of that number?
RD40. It's RD40. Yeah, it was relative density of 40.
Okay, so if I was to calculate RD40 for every one of those lines, that would be the number that I would come up with.
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Christine.
Okay, so what were the results of the no harvest zone eligibility? What I found in the 221 stands that I analyzed, or 212, I'm sorry, there were 203 that met the eligibility. So only 8 stands weren't eligible to be thinned. 96% contained stands that had enough trees in the no harvest zone. So then the next question is, is there enough trees that, will there be enough trees left unharvested in the thinning zone after you're going to conduct your harvest activity? This is the other table. So two tables you only need to use in this table. Very, very simple, no analysis, just two tables that you need to use. This table shows the total number of conifer trees. Now, this is only conifers in the inner, in the thinning zone. No live conifer trees that need to be left after harvest. And as Ken said, it is an idea 50. So, for instance, for a stand with an average diameter of, say, 15 inches, you need to have at least 159 trees per acre in order to thin that thinning zone. And those need to be left after the harvest activity is conducted. Pretty simple. So the results of what I found when I took the 203 eligible stands, if they would be able to be harvested, so I found 112 of the 203 stands that were eligible. 55%, roughly half of the stands that I sampled, contained enough trees in the thinning zone to be left unharvested. Thus, the forester or the landowner was able to thin the riparian area. Yes?
Did you do an analysis of the range of the number of trees that could be taken?
Yes. And I don't have that with me, mm-hmm. but we did. We have an idea of how many trees you actually are able to take to maintain, make sure that you have the trees left unharvested and how many trees you're able to take. We've done it, and I'll show you what we did with that. Using the number of trees that you're able to take, what's the value and what's the volume that you would be able to realize. So the bottom line is, are the stands actually viable? So yeah, you can thin in the thinning area, you can take some trees out, but is it actually worth the landowner's time to do that? And is it worthwhile for the landowner to do that? So the questions that we needed to ask was, is there enough volume of timber to be removed to have a viable thinning activity? And is there enough value for the landowner to make money on this? So we did those two analyses, and found that the average volume per acre of timber that can be removed was about 7,700 board feet of timber on average. And that's a 1 acre, on average, 1 acre size of a riparian area. So we have a current range of delivered domestic and delivered export. And I'm not a forester myself, so I know what this means, but I'm calculating it. We determined that the export value was about $540 per 1,000 board feet. The domestic volume value, meaning if we sold it and kept it in the United States, it would be about $490 per 1,000 board feet. We were very conservative for analysis. We used the delivered domestic values, which showed the average value per acre of the timber that can be removed is about $3,600. So there was a little bit of money that could be made. This is per acre. There's a little bit of money that can be made for this activity.
How much cost to do that?
We didn't determine the cost. That we used the delivered price. And as well as considering the fact that the landowner will most likely be in that area in the upland conducting an activity anyway.
Tammy, may I ask if that's additional value?
This is additional value in the that they can take over the standard rules.
Gross.
Per acre.
That's additional gross revenue, not value.
Right.
The value would be that less about half for the cost, or 40% or something like that. Would be
that's correct.
Usual cost.
Right.
Plus setup.
We figured that this would be an association with an upland harvest. We knew that the upland harvest for them to be able to do it, they would calculate the move-in costs and the haul costs. However, there's still costs associated with the removal of these trees and the hauling costs. That's highly variable. So for this analysis, we just used a delivered. We didn't try to calculate what the costs would be.
Thank you. Are there additional questions on the presentation?
Yeah. Oh,
I'm sorry. Do you have a question on the presentation?
How is the level of RD50 selected for this analysis as being the threshold? And bring to mind some comments that have been made earlier in testimony that somewhere between 35 or 30 and 45 is sort of the optimum growth level for forests, and 50 is getting close to the point of at which the stand shuts down and you begin to have competition-induced mortality. So, again, my question, how is 50 selected as a threshold?
The 50 was selected through the discussions with within the state caucus and then with the other stakeholder, the other caucuses. In developing this, the state caucus did go to the tribal caucus, the conservation caucus, and the federal services. They did review and give us input. The objective was to allow a thinning without a long-term compromise of riparian function. One of the major concerns expressed by some in the process was shade. So a higher RD of 50 was the value used for this template.
And I might add, Norm, we had an opportunity, DNR staff took me and a few other folks out onto some DNR managed lands that had different relative densities that were that part of a different part of their adaptive management program for state lands, which is separate from here, but we had an opportunity to walk through stands of different relative densities and had one of our DNR state lands silviculturalists talk about relative density and the point at which you do have essentially a shutdown of growth. He did not indicate that a relative density of 50 would lead to a shutdown of growth. Now, I am certainly not a silviculturalist, so I don't want to get into that debate. But I can tell you that when we walked through those stands, and we walked through stands of higher relative density, he in no way indicated that that was a stand that was in shutdown mode at all. They cut to that relative density to allow for increased growth. And I'm sure we could, you know, have him talk to us if we wish to, but yes.
I'm sure that there's a variance of opinion amongst a number of silviculturists and mensurationists is exactly
right.
Where that point is. There is no fixed point,
right.
But there certainly are tendencies. I guess maybe more fundamentally than just why 50, and you did talk about shade, would be what riparian functions would not be met at a lower relative density than 50.
The primary concern was the shade function. If I might, rather than going into a formula on how to calculate relative density, in real simple terms, relative density is the percent of the site occupied by the trees. So, and when you do a thinning, you open up the stand where, you know, where trees is the canopies touch, and the light becomes excluded from the lower limbs and the trees begin to react. And in many cases, a stand that's growing very, very tight, the trees will put on height and not really diameter. And conversely, if they're too open, then we get, you know, our wolf trees and they're just these big, huge, fat things with huge limbs and it's very low value lumber. What we looked at is that the big difference between an RD of 50, which is keeping that stand a little tighter, and an RD of 40, which we looked at when we went out and looked at the DNR sites, would be the time in which it would take for the canopy to reclose. And in the stand that we were in, it was about a decade. At an RD of 50, it would take longer if it was thin to an RD of 40. But again, it's a management of the trees that are in the riparian zone. We did look at the eligibility, and for the eligibility, we looked at all tree species, so hardwood and conifer alike. We just wanted to make sure that the core still maintained the riparian function. So, as I said earlier, we need to look at the long-term goals, as well as providing protection today. So the theory was that RD of 50 would be better, and that inner zone or the thinning zone because it would not be an extended period of time where the canopy remains open.
And if I may, just one follow-up on here, and I don't know if I can find it here quickly. It may have been in some of the stuff that Ken submitted in his written testimony that we received, or in some of your report. I'd have to take a moment to find it. But I believe it said something like, and I may be off by five or something, but that crown closure essentially is achieved at an RD of about 20. So if you have crown closure, by definition, that means you've got shade, because the crowns are touching. So it seemed like you could get basically full shade on the stream, and it, granted, you're at least 50 feet away from the stream at that point, because you're only talking about the thinning zone, not the no harvest zone. So all of that shade is at least already 50 feet farther away from the edge of the stream, and at 20 you're getting crown closure, and again, by definition, you're getting full shade. So it begs me the question of that metric being selected, which seems to be a key point in the differences between the state proposal and the small forest landowner proposal, and why we haven't been able to achieve something that folks can agree on. It's at least one of the major sticking points, and I have a real problem with the selection of that metric from my own personal and professional experience.
I understand where you come from. However, in the stands, natural growing stands, that before thinning, regardless of the relative density, there's a high probability that their canopies have closed at that point in time. As soon as you begin to thin trees, you are creating openings. So again, that's what we looked at, and you could clearly see that in the stand that we went to had been thinned just a couple years ago. So the stand at the point of the thinning had a closed canopy, and I don't recall what the relative density was at the point in which they initiated the thinning. But at the conclusion of the thinning, they did create openings because they had removed trees, and that part of the canopy that had been occupied by the trees that were removed were now open. And so it was a timing consideration as to when that canopy would reclose.
And if you want to maintain maximum growth and the ability to close that canopy back up, you thin to a lower relative density and more often than leaving it to a real high density where the crowns shut down. And that's what's happening when you get to that high level. It's exactly the opposite, I think, of what the intent is in setting a threshold number. The way in which you can get trees to respond is to have them have a little bit of space to what that they can grow. And by the time they get jammed in together and they reach the 50 and 55 and higher relative densities, their ability to respond becomes less, not more.
Yeah. Again, though, as Mr. Stinson pointed out, an RD of 50 is right at that point where you're beginning to see stem exclusion.
Yes.
One of the riparian function is the recruitment of large woody debris. And when you start to see trees begin to die, at that point you are recruiting large woody debris. So a higher relative density may also argue in favor of meeting that riparian function, where you're encouraging a certain number of trees to die.
It sounds like we have some conflicting goals trying to accomplish at the same time. You can't have it both ways. I'm sorry.
I'm just trying to help shed some more light on how we got to an RD of 50. And my understanding was that since the template is starting with smaller buffers than the buffers in the standard rule, that was part of why it needed to be a little bit more conservative than we otherwise might consider, just because of the functions that Mark's talking about, shade and water quality standards. So maybe that, I don't know if that helps at all, but that was part of my understanding. And if smaller buffers isn't part of what small forest landowners want from this type of a template, then maybe that's another useful point to keep in mind. But Mark, is that accurate? Or
that was also one of the concerns expressed by people involved in the development of the template. Yes.
Follow up.
Couple points. You know, one is that I think that there is a trade-off, it seems, between trying to protect current function and trying to encourage, you know, future growth of trees. And I think that, you know, in an attempt to have a simpler set of prescriptions, there's inevitably going to be some of those trade-offs instead of doing more complicated analyses to try to figure out how to maybe optimize the trade-offs. So that would be just one point, that there might be just some limitations, you know, on the scale of simplification versus maximum flexibility. The second thing, back in the day, Tammy, when you and I worked together on the HCP for DNR, I remember doing analyses of RD versus canopy cover, and RD50 was around, I mean, there was some variability around the scattered data points, but it was around a 70% canopy cover, and that was always a target for spotted owl habitat. But it strikes me that maybe in an attempt to try to resolve some of these conflicts over is RD50 too high or not, it might be interesting to see data from shade models. And the shade is a big point of concern, like looking at the lower limit of RD and being in certain situations being able to provide adequate shade, especially if you're next to a 50-foot, you know, high system. And so maybe for another round, or, you know, another template, that could be something that could help, you know, walk through all of the stakeholders. Maybe that's something that was already done, and we're just not getting that detail here. But it seems like that's an important relationship that people can actually see. You know, if you're going to too low an RD, you're not getting the shade that's required to maintain your stream temperature, then that's a pretty hard and fast number. So that might just be something for you all to look at or for you to present to us at some future meeting.
Okay. That makes sense.
Doug?
Mark, I got a more basic question. When you guys couldn't come to agreement here between the small forest landowner group and the other members, why didn't this just get dropped? I mean, I don't see this situation in pushing it. If you kind of were at loggerheads, and yet you wanted to push this to the board, I'm a little confused there as to what the purpose of that was. It seems to me like, why not just go back to the status quo? Small landowners saying we don't want it, it's not going to do any good. Why didn't you just leave it at that and say, hey, we're just not going to be able to get together?
I think I might be able to answer that better, but you're welcome to. But it's not really a staff decision at that point, in all honesty. I think that we had a lot of internal conversations about whether it would be appropriate to bring this template to the board. I think it's important to know that DNR is required to develop board manuals and bring them to the board. We spent a year of state's time on this template, and we feel that we genuinely do have a good voluntary tool to put in the toolbox. It does meet the forest and fish functional criteria test that is always difficult to meet. But we've spent that considerable amount of time. We've brought all the other caucuses on board, and we feel that this genuinely does represent another opportunity. We don't think we're done. We know there are more templates to be developed. There are more options that we're going to try to explore, but this one meets the functions. And rather than spend a year of the state's time on something and then to throw it away, when we feel that it genuinely provides an option. We don't think it's the only option. We don't think it's the answer to the entire low-impact template. Notice we're not calling it a low-impact template, but we feel that it is a good tool for the toolbox, and to spend that much time on something and for a product that we genuinely believe can provide, you know, a minimum of $3,600 additional gross, granted, per acre, it felt like it was something we could put in the toolbox. We also heard when we brought the fixed width template and the long-term applications that those wouldn't be good. And we're seeing those used more and more. And so we recognize that it's not the answer to everything, but it felt like it would be a tool. Again, it's voluntary. Nobody has to use it. If it's truly not functional, we'll see that. But if it's something that we could use to at least provide another opportunity, it felt like the right thing to do
after that investment of all of our time, to at least let the board have an opportunity to debate it.
You know, Madam Chairman, that sounds to me like we're shoving her down your throat. That's what you're getting to me when you tell me that. And I just say, what are you telling the small landowner, not to bring anything more up to make it bring forward?
I encourage more conversation, but I also encourage bringing something that isn't a final offer. It felt like any time we move beyond what is initially put on the table, the answer is no. It has to meet function. It has to be a collaborative discussion. I encourage you to continue it, and I encourage Ken. I've talked with him privately about it. I would love to try to meet the intent of the low impact and create a variety of templates to do this, but it has to be something that meets function. We don't have the ability or authority
the RD issue is obviously the discussion right here today. It's not even close to being settled.
The RD is just one feature, though, I might point out. I mean, there are other eligibility requirements and considerable other differences. The RD is not the only point of discrepancy between the two.
Well, first you got a 50-foot core, no touch, and you got, what is it, 96 trees in there at 18 inches? My God, that's a buffer and a half right there. I mean, that's a tremendous amount of wood right there next to the stream. You know, I disagree with you, Bridget. I think it's really a poor way to bring something all the way up to the board. I think it should be discussed further. And if there were some good suggestions made in. Let's have some discussion on RD. See if we can't get that resolved. But to bring it this way up to the board, I think is if that's the way the SEMR has to operate, I mean, I've not seen this done in the past with anything coming out of SEMR. I mean, where's consensus? I mean, we're kind of going the other way now and saying consensus isn't as important.
Well, just as a reminder, board manuals aren't from the SEMR process, and there have been other board manuals that have not reached consensus that DNR has brought to the board, and they have approved them. The manual in and of itself is guidance on how to meet the rules. It's not mandatory, it's not a new rule, and so it's not something that goes through that full process. It's something that DNR is required to develop in consideration and consultation with all the different entities, and we've done that. I recognize that it doesn't meet what you want. I genuinely believe that. I wish it did. If I thought that the only difference was the relative density, which at one point I did, and I pushed to see if we could push the relative density down, if that would make it more palatable, and the response was absolutely not. So it's not purely a relative density question. So I absolutely respect that this is not the optimal way of bringing things to the board, but again, we don't feel like we're done. This isn't, to us, the last approach to attempt at a low-impact template. We want to see other pieces come before us to give small landowners that opportunity to get the most value they can out of their land. But we genuinely believe that this tool in the toolbox is a good idea.
Couldn't disagree with you more. Yes. And thank you for your approach. I wanted to hear that, and I'm really glad. I was sort of, one other part that kind of adds in there to me. It looks to me like perhaps you want that in there for a tool in the toolbox because it looks good even though it's not used.
I absolutely do not want it in the toolbox purely to tell people it's in the toolbox. And that's an item that's been cast back and forth as to whether having it in the toolbox is good for us or having it not in the toolbox is better for the small landowners. That's not my objective. My objective is to get you a tool that helps you work. I'm not developing tools to try to use them in another forum. I'm developing tools for this forum for the small landowners to use them.
Thank you. I just want to say that I appreciate this coming forward myself. It seems pretty obvious that it doesn't make everybody happy, but it's it does seem like a step in the right direction, and it does seem like it brings value in a voluntary way that people can use if they want, and if they don't want to use, they don't have to use it. But I had a question related to that. You offered some numbers about the data set that you used to look at how this might be applied and who it might be able to benefit. I just kind of wanted to go back to that for a minute. How generally applicable do you think both of those key things are, that eligibility, who might be eligible? You said 96% in your sample. How applicable is that to the general? And then 55, about half of those would actually be able to benefit from it in terms of having extra trees to harvest.
I think it's completely applicable. I think it's good. It would be very usable based on the data that I saw and based on the DSC stand data that I ran in the size of the riparian areas that I analyzed, which was about an acre. It was very much used. I think this would be a good benefit to small forest landowners.
If I could add, just before, so go back to the to our presentation. So we looked in townships that had a percentage of small forest landowners. The average stand was 49 years old. So these stands originated prior to the forest practice rules in areas where there's a lot of small forest landowner ownership on streams flowing across both industrial as well as small forest landowner properties. So we do not, we gathered the data blind. It was just what data is available within that township. We don't know whose lands, who collected the stand data. But in the areas that we went and looking at the ortho photos, it appeared that these stands are very similar across the landscape. So that's why we believe that this analysis will be applied. Again, and I'm saying this because we've been told that small forest landowners, that they find the DFC rules as being very complex and hard for them to use, and that not very many are out measuring trees and then running the model. But again, when you look at the mosaic, the areas in which we gathered the data, they have a presence in that area, and the stand, the age of the stands is representative of the whole area.
A couple things. I did want to acknowledge something you said about it seeming like it would be a big waste of time to just throw this particular template out after a year of staff time was spent. And I would just agree with that given budget limitations we have right now. And you know, at the same time, I think it's pretty clear that the small forest landowner community that's represented here today is not happy with this particular template. But I would also encourage it to be adopted and tried to see what can be learned. And you know, as you said, Bridget, truly, if it's not functional or it doesn't provide the opportunities that Tammy's data indicated that it did, then that's something to learn. And then I think, you know, in the meantime, more discussions can be had. But I would hate to see this effort go to waste. And I would also encourage, if there's the ability to do so, to have some formal analysis along the way as it's applied, both as an attempt to fine tune it, but then also to see, you know, to test the assumptions about function. So, you know, how does leaving an RDU 50, given different diameter distributions, how does that actually affect shade? How does that actually affect you know, litter and sediment interception and woody debris delivery? And if that can be incorporated either into adaptive management or effectiveness monitoring, then those are things to be learned. At the same time, I mean, I understand the political considerations in small forest landowner community. I would have a hard time thinking anybody would think that the adoption of this template would, you know, sort of smooth over all of the issues about their not, you know, feelings of there not being enough flexibility, feelings of you know, financial commitments not being fully met through you know, full funding of REP and other programs. So you know, I certainly wouldn't see adopting this template as
as an attempt to say, you know, everything's fine, we're washing our hands and walking away. So I just wanted to make that clear. I think it's a good attempt. I understand there's still frustrations. I would like to see it adopted and implemented and see what we can do. And thank you for your work. Nora.
Just several last questions. Can the data set be made available that you've utilized? I'd like to have a look at that, please.
Yes, I have it available if you'd like to see it.
Yeah, thank you. On the tables, this is on page M21, 25, and 27. There are two tables, and they're truncated at 16 inches on the small end and 28 on the large end on one table and 12 and 30 on the other end. Is there a reason why those are truncated? Could there be extensions of those numbers? I guess maybe not on the larger side, but you want to have a minimum number of trees. I understand that. But if the stand diameter was, for example, less than 16 inches, is it ineligible? That's on table 3.
If it's less than 16 inches, you still need to maintain the 115.
So that's 16 or less.
It's okay. 16 or less.
Right. Okay. And the same on the 12 then. All right. Correct. So, okay.
And same on the greater then. Yeah. So yeah. It's 28.
All right. Okay. Thank you. And I know that it's the difference between the RD40 on one table, table 3, and RD50 on table 5. Table 3 at RD40 being the 50 feet closest to the stream, and table 5 at RD50 being farther from the stream. And so again, I would just question the rationale for the ability to provide function at seemingly a lower relative density closer to the stream, where it's a higher relative density that would be required farther away from the stream. It seemed to me that inherently it might be the opposite.
The table created for the trees closest to the stream are for all species, hardwood and conifer alike, or the thinning table is for conifer only. This is a conifer thinning, it's not a hardwood thinning.
So that means that there would be even fewer conifer trees closer to the stream.
There could be fewer conifer trees in the core, but we're looking at all trees combined.
Okay, so again, I'm going back. Go back to functions, not numbers of trees. The presumption, it seems like, that it's being made is that fewer conifer trees close to the stream meet function, but more conifer trees farther away from the stream are required to meet function. That's the way that the thinning would pan out. You would have to have way more in the area beyond 50 feet than you would have to have in the area closer to 50 feet. And so how does that requirement meeting function when it's so much greater outside?
One of the major concerns are that the areas closest to streams, and we even saw this on state lands, tend to have a higher percentage of hardwood trees. And as you go further away, you'll get a higher percentage of conifer trees, kind of the difference between the full riparian and then the upland stands. What we don't want for this template, and why we made it an eligibility, is that those landowners, and there's a lot of them down in the area where I used to work in the Columbia River Gorge, where the areas immediately adjacent to the streams are basically brush holes. There aren't any trees at all. There's a lot of brush and no trees. So what we wanted as an eligibility was a stand, both hardwood and conifer combined, that would meet riparian function today. And that then the stand behind, which is a conifer stand, can be more intensively managed and can grow back into riparian function easier. We don't want it, though, however, to allow a thinning where there is not enough trees within the core to meet riparian function. So that's why you're seeing a difference in relative density, and that's why you're also seeing that in the core we will look at both hardwood and conifer.
Yeah, I understand that you're not wanting to just have brush holes next to the stream. But when the requirement for relative density after thinning is greater for conifer only, outside, if more than 50 feet from the stream edge, from bank full width edge, it's suggesting that more of the function for that stream is coming from the thinning zone than is coming from the no harvest zone. And that, you know, you're farther away from your stream, you're providing more function. That, again, is that is not supported by any of the science about management of riparian functions along streams. None. That, shade, sediment control, litter fall, habitat, none of it happens farther from the stream than closer to the stream, but that's what this model is pushing towards.
Let's give the staff a moment to respond to that, please.
Yeah, the issue here does come down to the intensity of thinning. We were asked by the small forest landowner community when they first brought this in to consider a template, an additional template. They were looking at a low impact template, and again, there were some concerns about the degree to which they want to go. In other words, they went to an applicability in a lot larger scale than what we felt we could do. You have to keep in mind that as the state caucus approached this, we wanted to work within the parameters of the rule. Now, if you want to question a lower relative density, we felt that that would be something that would have to, as you said, embrace science. And when you reach that point, then it's better that that analysis be directed to the adaptive management program. And we were clearly asked by the small forest landowner community to not take the template to the into the adaptive management process for development. So, if I may say, we did take a conservative approach, where as a result of the prescription that we put together, we felt that we were staying within the function as it is currently laid out in rule. We didn't want to push that envelope to the point where, as I said at the end of my presentation, where we begin to make new rule through guidance.
Thank you. We are getting behind on our agenda. Tom, I know you had a comment. Why don't you go ahead and we'll open the discussion.
Yes, first of all, I just would like to thank staff for their hard work on this. This, again, is I'm still somewhat of a newcomer on this group, and I'm amazed at the level of work and the details that you work within. There seems to be an assumption that anything short of our approval today will be a loss to this entire effort, and or a waste of staff resources. And I'm concerned with that because I think there still seems to be, given the discussion here and some of the questions asked, where we can take what's done and continue to have discussions and build on it and improve it. Again, that's my opinion. But the purpose of the template, from what I'm hearing, is to provide an alternate plan for the small forest landowners. And yet we're hearing from the group of folks that it's designed to assist that, at least a subset of that group. I mean, I have no way of knowing how many small forest landowners share the opinion of the folks that were here today speaking to us. But from those that have talked to us, I'm hearing they oppose both the template and the process that has been used to develop it, and that they oppose this template being moved forward. Again, I can only take it upon what they're saying, and that they do in some way, well, obviously in some way they represent the entire entity of small forest landowners, but I don't know how many. So that's a question I still have. But given that, I believe more work needs to be done on the template, and I would certainly encourage that be allowed to happen, that we allow more work to be done, more discussions. And, you know, at Department of Agriculture, we're a different, we handle, you know, different regulations. We are a regulatory agency, but our culture is somewhat different. and that we don't move things forward unless we have close agreement with the folks that we're working with. Again, I know that's a different regulatory scheme, different culture, but that's what I bring to this table. And from what I'm hearing from the folks that this template is designed to help, is that they're not happy with it in its present condition. I would just like to encourage this group to consider holding the vote off until more discussions can take place and more agreement can be reached.
Tom, other questions or statements?
Yes. Tom, I just want to thank you for those remarks, and I'd like to take your advice on, hey, let's keep working on this, let's keep devoting effort. I guess I'm just having watched how this process has gone, and like you said, it seems like no one has been happy with how the process has gone. So just, if we're going to consider that as a board, as part of our recommendation, in either stalling a vote, or if we do pass it today, and like Paula was suggesting, do some intense follow-up on how it's actually working and being used, I just feel like we would need to have some kind of recommendations or discussion amongst ourselves on how to guide that process, because I had some similar observations as the chair with it. Really, both sides need to approach it from, we're willing to collaborate, to negotiate. It's not an all or nothing deal. So I don't have a great suggestion for how we can do that, but just I don't think it would be sufficient to say let's keep working on it without any kind of different direction or guidance or.
I would second that. I mean, the reason it's before the board today is because we feel like we've worked it to a point where further work between staff and stakeholders would not change the outcome. So it was deliberate and recognizing an impasse.
Tom, I'd like to thank, I think the Ag's got a very good approach. Very good approach.
Okay, thank you for your presentation. The board now has the opportunity to discuss a motion to adopt the template if they so choose. Is there a motion that's available?
I'll move to adopt the template. Oh, look, there's a motion right there.
It's called staff work.
It's exactly what I was thinking, too. I move the Forest Practices Board approve Board Manual Section 21, Alternate Plans, that includes the new thinning strategy template for small forest landowners. I further move to allow staff to make minor editorial changes if necessary prior to distribution.
Second.
Let me just make a remark. I see, you know, that there's a very interesting discussion about how do we keep moving forward here. I feel like this is a clear step forward. It provides real dollar value to small forest landowners who want to take advantage of it. Those that don't have to. But I don't want to close the door on this discussion either. I think the way Paula described it was really quite excellent, that we ought to look at refining this as we can. And if there's an additional direction perhaps that the board wants to take here relative to making sure that we don't just walk away from this, I'm very open to that. I think the discussion about relative density is very interesting, but it's not going to be a very quick, I don't think there's going to be a quick answer there. We've had some very good minds at work here, and I don't think that they're just missing something. I'm certainly willing to do that. But while we're doing it, there are some people out there that could take advantage of this template. You know, next week they could earn more money on their property, and I don't think we should take that away from folks just because we're wrangling about it. Let's take this step forward, and let's keep working on it.
Tom, Dave.
Thank you. I think I pretty much concur with what Tom is saying. I think that the way we keep describing, or the way you've described this, is this is another tool in the toolbox. And so I think it's important to keep that in mind, that and there are people that may choose to use this, and we do need to, I think, take a look and see how well, this works or not, but at the same time, I think we're committing to keep working on developing other tools to put into the toolbox. I do think it's important that we take the time that's been invested in developing this and approve it today. Like Paula describes, let's see how it works. But again, not wanting to foreclose the opportunity to keep developing new tools.
Doug?
Well, I happen to think it's a step backwards for the board to move forward on this. I think it's a real sad day myself. And I think it's very interesting that you heard from the small landowners, you heard from the DARE, some of our best tree farmers in the state. I think it would be rather foolish of you to think that there are other people out there, Tom, that are going to run out and use this program. They're not. You know, I mean, you heard what they had to say, so you're just going 180 degrees in the opposite direction. I really kind of question that, the validity of it. So from my standpoint, it's a very poor move. Very poor move to not take the time to resolve this further. So it costs a little money, big deal. Look at the money Seymour spends all the time. What's this? It's nothing. I think there's a power play here myself. I mean, I can't understand why in the world you'd want to push something that the people that initially brought to the table, you know, find it not workable at all.
I think this proposal lacks some technical and scientific justification that I think we can get around, given some time to work on it and refine. I think that there probably are some different metrics that might be chosen that will still meet functions, that will still not trigger an adaptive management process that would be necessary. But it will take a little bit of time for us to get there. In order to get there, it will need a commitment on the part of the Small Landowner Caucus, the representatives that have been here that are burned out and that are tired, and they may not be willing to give that. And I've talked with some of them offline, and so, you know, I'll stick my neck out there and say I will not support this going forward because I want them to come back to the table and see if we can find something that meets their needs better, that will still meet the requirements and the needs of the regulatory program of the other stakeholders. So I would strongly suggest, and I will vote that we not approve this, but that we do try to bring folks back to the table. And if after this meeting the small forest landowners come back to us and say we're not coming back, no way, no how, then next meeting we'll vote to do something different. But I think to accept it now is a slap in their face, as they have come to us and said we cannot support it. This is something that's meant to be for them, but they've come essentially unanimously. We've not had a single small forest landowner come forward and say this is a good thing. I think it's wrong for us to adopt it on that basis, but I would hope that we could find something that we could actually meet a better solution that would be acceptable.
Thank you. Tom?
I just once again thank staff for their work. I mean, in my comments, I don't want to offend them for the hard work they've done, recognizing, you know, the amount of time that this has taken. And I appreciate, Madam Chair, this robust discussion. I mean, this has been very helpful. In my time on the board, I think this may be the first vote that comes down to be as close as this one will be. And to me, that's significant. I mean, it shows that there obviously isn't that we're split. The industry, the small forest landowners are split on this, or at least they're split from where the agency department is at this point. And to me, that should be a signal that we ought to take a step back and allow this more time. But I have a sense of where this is going today. And so, you know, I'll accept wherever that goes. But again, I'm discouraged that that's what's happening today.
Do we have time to keep talking? Or do
we're
take
well behind schedule, so I think we all know that this is a difficult day for the board. This is not going to be a unanimous vote. It is not the type of votes we like to take at any time. But I think we have all stated the reasons for why we will vote in the way we will vote. And unless there are any other last-minute statements, I'd like to call for the vote. Okay. All those in favor of the motion as presented on the board and seconded appropriately, please say aye.
And raise your hand.
And raise your hand. Aye.
Aye.
We have five.
Hey, I vote. Excuse me. Go ahead.
All those opposed, say no.
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 Five. So it goes. There is not approved. So we'll have a tie vote, and we will pick it up next time.
Maybe.
Maybe. I can't see that it's an area that has a lot of fruit to be gained. I hope it does. Okay, we're an hour behind schedule. I'd like to take a break. We have a couple of difficult topics still to come, so let's take a moment and move on. So we'll take a 10-minute break.